And now, the Big D and Bubba Weekly Podcast.
Big D and Bubba, they have a show 5 days a week, but they don't get to say everything that's on their mind, so they have an extra one, and that's how we get
the podcast.
Big D and Bubba podcast, Big D and Bubba podcast.
I feel deep embarrassment all of a sudden.
Why? I thought about you. I thought about it. As soon as that played,
I thought,
oh, wow,
oh
what
my God,
a horrible
a real
position.
Musician, hey, a real, like a guy who actually is in charge of real music just heard me just, sing that's the podcast. Know,
that's the first thing he heard. That's the first thing he heard.
That is his. Now that's what you're going to be remembered by. Real quick, let me get into the specifics before we dive into the podcast this week. It is going to be fun. If you're watching live on Facebook, make sure you click the little button that says live subscribe. That way you get to watch it all the time and you never miss one. Again, that's right there on the right-hand corner of the video. So you're good to go. And the podcast sponsored by LifeLock. No one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions at all businesses, but LifeLock Ultimate Plus provides the most comprehensive identity theft protection. You want to go to LifeLock.com and use promo code BIGD to save yourself 10%.
The reason Patrick was embarrassed is because of our guest who's sitting to his right, John Esposito, who is the Chief Executive Officer and President, Warner Music Nashville, huge record label, and who...
Hears, you know, people yeah. sing
talent.
Every day.
Hears actual good singers sing and preach good songs, and then you get...
Welcome.
Had you never told me that was you, I wouldn't have known.
Dang it!
That's right.
I won't be able to get it out of my head.
Every time you see me from now on, you're going to go,
the podcast. And then our little singing along with it doesn't help either,
no,
does it?
No, it really doesn't.
John goes by Espo. It's what everyone calls him. But welcome, by the way, and he was feeling kind of under the weather, so we weren't sure he's going to be able to make it, but we're glad you're here, man.
I'm glad to be here.
So tell us about, for those who don't know you, those who are outside, which is most of the people who are listening are outside of the industry, don't know what you do. What do you do?
What does a record label head do? I'm the biggest cheerleader inside the building, and I'm also the hall monitor. It's my responsibility to shoot the wankers and try to elevate the ones who show a little wankdom but might be talented. And then if they all behave properly, I just get the pom-poms out.
Right.
If they do their jobs.
You've got like,
I'm going to run down a little list of the people you're in charge of.
Wait, before you do that, let me say, when you got to Warner Brothers in 2009.
The end of 2009.
In the years just prior to that, you had one artist who had gotten some number ones.
Yeah.
That would Blake Shelton.
Blake Shelton.
And then all of these guys Bubba's going to name are your fault.
Yeah.
Since okay. Blake Shelton.
So are you, not only are you in charge of like the country stuff, but you're in charge of comedy as well, I would assume.
Yeah.
Blake Shelton, Jimmy Fallon, Cole Swindell, Dan and Shay, Hunter Hayes, Jenna Kramer, Brett Eldridge, Michael Ray, Frankie Ballard, Kenny Rogers, Larry the Cable Guy, Ashley Monroe, Bone Collector, Gloriana, Big Smoke, Kid Rock, Ryan Kinder, Randy Travis, Chris Jansen, Henry Cho, Bill Ingvall, Lisa Lampanelli, Charlie Worsham, The Railers, and Jeff Foxworthy. That's a pretty good list.
Oh, I need a raise.
You definitely do. First of all, I could name three people on that list that you need a raise because you have to deal with them. But that is also in a good way because some of our favorite people on the planet are on there. Like Jeff Foxworthy is the most, I don't know about your dealings with him, but for us, he's always been one of the coolest friends of the show. Like we could call him for anything. He's like, hey, yeah, absolutely, I'll do that. You know, he's super awesome.
I have a guy who works for me. He's the general manager of the label. His name's Peter Strickland. And Peter has been at the label, I think, 21 years. He's from Boston. He's 6'5", has a thick Boston accent. And among other things, in addition to he's been the only product manager Randy Travis has ever had or Blake Shelton has ever had, he developed that comedy business for us. So Peter does most of the interacting with those guys. Every one of my interactions with people like Jeff have been magic. But it was the reason I'm telling you this story is because Jimmy Fallon, when he decided he wanted to make a comedy record, said, I want whoever it is who did all those guys' records.
Uh-huh.
And called up. Literally, Peter gets a phone call saying Jimmy Fallon's on the phone. This was when he was on the Late Late Show, but we knew that Fallon was going to be big time.
Yep.
And Jimmy's become a big friend of the family. We got him a Grammy. Well, he got himself a Grammy, but, you know, we were the ones involved in putting that record out.
I'm sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to say, how hard is it for a number one song to come about?
You know, it's amazing. I have been here 6.5 years, and my standard line is the first year felt like 10 and the next 5 felt like 1, you know, because I had to do some serious cleaning out of both the staff and the roster. And in fact, there were only 2 artists signed to the label when I got here who still are on the label.
When you say roster, though, you mean those are the artists, singers?
Blake and who's the other one that was?
Frankie Ballard, who had been signed about 3 months before I got there, so he hadn't even been in the studio recording, you know. And for Blake, just as an example, you have an artist who had 5 number one records over 8 years. He had about 15 misses, as it were, over that 8 years before I took the reins, and now we've got 16 in a row. Actually, we're on our way to our 17th in a row.
Because what's the difference? I mean, it's obviously he's still him. He didn't change really a whole lot of his style, I don't think.
No.
What changed? Obviously, you came in the picture.
Yeah, and I don't want to, you know, my credit, I wasn't joking so much when I talked about the pom-poms. And my job is to keep people focused, right? It's real easy to get distracted in this business. And I looked at the roster when I got here and I said, Blake is amazingly talented. We've failed him for all the misses that he had, and we're not going to do that anymore. We're going to build the building around him. So I'm a pretty benevolent dictator, but I'm a guy who says, this is our focus, everybody, all hands on deck. And it starts with A&R. Scott Hendricks, who runs our A&R, happens to be Blake's producer, and he'd been there 2 years before I got there. And he's, you know, Scott's now on his 63rd number one record as a producer, right? So Scott knows what he's doing, but he wasn't allowed to do what he's best at, which is just have creative freedom. He and Blake got my, you know, blessing to just, you guys pick the songs. I'll trust you because that's your job in A&R. And then I had to turn the promo staff over, and there are really only 2 people left from the promo team from when I got here. These are not prideful things, but these are the kind of decisive things I have to do as leader. I want to be funnier than this, by the way, but you're asking this question,
This is how it starts.
Let me say, okay, so there's several major record labels in Nashville, and each one of them has a guy or girl that is the guy, that's their guy. You know, right now I would say that UMG, it's Luke Bryan, you know, and at Big Machine, it's still Taylor. But in your world, you had to get there and go, why isn't Blake our guy? Like,
that's
right?
pretty accurate.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
So when you put the force of the whole company behind this guy and go, that's the guy, and then look what happens. He goes from being Blake Shelton to being Blake Shelton.
Dude, I can tell you, Espo, I was at the grocery store 3 days ago, and I'm looking, and I see it was the National Enquirer. He's on the cover, and I was like, this is like bizarro world that Blake is on the cover of anything. And it's like he's a part of, it's just weird to have this guy that we've known forever who's awesome, and we love him. And I'm like you. I always like, why isn't he a bigger star?
You know, it takes everybody being on that boat. And Blake and I sat down one night when we were launching Hillbilly Bone, which was the first of the 16 consecutive number ones. And I said, Blake, we're going to build the building around you. I've just given this speech to our company, but it's all hands on deck. And we're going to need you to work harder than you've ever worked. And we're going to stretch you out there a bit. And Blake looked me in the eye and said, I'm in. I had actually met him because I've been with Warner Music going on 15 years now. I'd met him shortly after I joined the company at some function, and I thought he was one of the funniest guys I've ever met. Yeah. And I said, we're not getting any TV shows that show his character. And so our head of publicity was charged with, let's get him on those. It's great if he gets performances, but I want couch time as much.
So that was,
So that was actually planned, like to get him on TV and in front of cameras more?
100%. We got him on Chelsea Handler countless times. Chelsea Lately was what they call the show. Got him to co-host with Hoda in the 9 to 10 o'clock hour, and she fell in love with him and kept inviting him back because he was so damn funny. Right?
Yeah.
And then Jimmy Kimmel took a chance to have him play but also get couch time. And we literally went, because I'm a data freak, we went from, in 2009, he had zero TV appearances to 23 in 2010. So while the promo team's working Hillbilly Bone and then All About Tonight and then Who Are You When I'm Not Looking and getting them to number ones in that time period, America's finding out about this guy, which led to, at the end of that year, Mark Burnett seeing all of this and while trying to pick a hillbilly to be part of the four people on The Voice, said, well, he's funny, you know, and I think everybody went into that thing. Blake talks openly about how he was reluctant to do the show. Imagine that nowadays. But he went in as the least likely to succeed, right, because they had these big names.
All the pop stars.
Oh, my gosh. What? And, you know, I look at that and go, oh, it's the opposite.
It's the opposite.
It's all about personality. Yeah. It's all about being...
A name
totally
can get you
real.
A name can only get you so far, and an image can only get you so far.
If you can
fill in the blanks with humor and relatability and just fun, you win.
The first episode of The Voice, I remember watching it and then coming in the next day and going, guys, Blake Shelton's going to be the biggest star in the world. Because this was finally the first time that there's a national TV audience obsessed with this show because it's new. And there's you have Christina Aguilera and Adam Levine and all these big names. And then Blake's the star.
Yeah.
He's the funny one.
Blake helped all of them because he helped them get out of that structured, I care about what I look and how do I come across. And they get very unreal.
They let their hair down because of Blake.
Because of him.
You know?
So they should be thanking him.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think they are. Not sure about Christina. But I might say as well that his management team, Narvel and Brandon Blackstock, are amazing because it's. I have the perspective of this so etched in my head. We also did a concert that we shot in 2010 for broadcast on. It ended up being GAC, and then it got in some other places, and it was about showing how large. Bigger than life Blake was, right? And we had it shot by the same guy who did Billy Joel in Central Park and Garth in Central Park, you know. And it was really a purposeful step towards showing, as we were getting all these TV appearances and starting to get number ones, his look, you know, this 6'5", handsome goofball out there. And that was all Narvel's idea. And we shot it up in Evansville, Indiana. Nobody knows that because you had to pick some place where we could fill 4,000 seats. There were runners, runways, I should say, on the stage, and Blake had never used a runway in his entire life. And we start the rehearsal, and Blake's standing on the straight part of the stage.
Never going out on the runway.
And we had to stop, and Narvel going up there said, I put these here for a reason, Blake. Now if you go see Blake in concert, he's running all over this great grand stage. It loops around to the back. It goes out to the front of the audience. It's fun to watch people, you know, emerge like that.
Yeah. Can I just say, I take this personally more than I think Big D or Bubba does. When I feel this connection to the industry and the music, and I pick the music for the show, so I feel like, you know...
Like you're invested?
I'm invested in a lot of this. And we met Blake in the
beginning.
2000, 2001, you know, very early on, and he's been a constant... I mean, we created taxidermy for him for a wedding gift, which is like, you know, it's that kind of long-standing thing. And I'll never forget, like, I stood up and screamed and cheered, and I may have cried when Blake won Entertainer of the Year. It was like a personal pride, and I was at your party after that, and I can remember thinking, you must be the proudest person. That must have been
somewhere high
in your list of
proud
moments in your whole career.
Yeah, that was, I think, the year three of him winning the Male Vocalist.
Yeah.
And winning the Male Vocalist was the first plunger moment. You know, it meant so much to him. It's, you know, he wasn't even getting nominated in the years before. Now
Hillbilly
he was one
Bone
of the
was his first CMA.
Yeah, that's right.
Really?
For vocal event of the year.
Yeah,
yes.
Wow.
ACM, but yeah.
Oh, okay.
Right. So then he gets the award for Male Vocalist of the Year, and it's like, well, finally.
Yeah.
But we hugged each other at that party for about 15 minutes. It was probably uncomfortable for a lot of people around us.
Especially knowing Blake, because not only does he hug, but especially if he has a couple in him, he starts kissing.
Oh, yeah.
There's
yeah.
a lot of kissing
rubber.
Going on.
Yeah.
Running his fingers through your hair. It's great. Yeah.
Now, I have another story, if I would, about how do you get a number one song. So let's take Brett Eldredge, who was the first artist I signed after I got here. And I think everybody in town loved him because he's a really charming guy.
Yeah.
And he made a record that had some pretty decent songs.
You're talking about the album with Raymond on it? Or even before that.
The album that never got released, but Raymond happened to be one of the songs of.
Yeah.
Had this body of work that he and Byron Gallimore had produced, and a bunch of great writers in town. We take Raymond out. I think it gets to number 24. After all, I mean, that might have been 30 weeks till we realized that wasn't going to work. So then we come out with a second song from that, It Ain't Gotta Be Love. Same about effort, same about weeks, and about the same result in the charts, which means if you don't crack the top 20, nobody's really even heard it, you know,
right.
To be clear. We regrouped and said, you know what, we don't have another one to go to with this, but we know you're the most talented singer, you know, that we could be involved with, you know. He's so, so good, you know. He kind of gets challenged and goes back and creates what became his first album release, and the song Don't You is the lead song. And I had a very infamous experience for my team. We do this thing called Picking on the Patio, in which the third Thursday of all the summer months, we have a band play, an artist play, and Brett was playing. And this is after single number two failed. And I got up to the microphone and I said, ladies and gentlemen, I am committed to this boy, and this team is committed to this boy. But I'll tell you what, if we don't break this artist, I'm going to burn the building down. And everybody, my team looked shocked.
I was there,
you know.
Everybody was scared because I was like, he doesn't mean today, does he? Because like, we're on the porch.
Check his pockets quick.
Yeah, does he have matches? Because
in walks maybe 8 months later Brett's manager. And he hands me a pack of matches, you know, those big matches, you know, that the thing slides out of.
Yeah.
You can, you know, start kitchens that have ovens that have wood in them, fires with them. And he goes, you're not going to need these. And
that's,
I thought it was so
cool.
I put it on a shelf, and I can see it every day of the week. And then we went and released Don't You, and it was 54 weeks till it became number one. That means I've already given up 3.5 years of my life trying to get the first number one for this artist.
Yeah, some perspective. An average number one is 20 weeks.
For a brand new artist, it ends up being about 35 to 45 weeks.
But even 35 weeks compared to 54 is
tenacity.
It's a whole year. The song was out a whole year before it hit number one.
Yeah, right? But each song has become shorter, where this last one that went to number one, Drunk on Your Love, took 21 weeks, you know, and the ideal will be to get him into that wonderful air where Blake Shelton is, you know, where it's 12, 13 weeks. And we're getting there with Cole Swindell, too. His first single took, it was a pretty supercharged record, but it still took 40 weeks to get Chillin' It to number one.
It just seems like so much.
It's a crapshoot, man. It's a crapshoot because you believe in somebody and you say, okay, we're going to put everything we got behind you, but there's no guarantees. I mean, it's insane. Like you could have a Blake and you don't know if it's going to blow up or not, or a Brett Eldredge. I mean, as you said, you were banging your head up against the wall, and I don't know, man. It's almost like radio, actually. It's almost like ratings. It's something completely out of your control. You can do the most and the best thing you can, but it really is up to the end user and if they want to take it in.
Yeah, I tell you, star alignment is an interesting thing because the number of incredibly talented artists who no longer have record deals is a very, very long list, right? It takes a combination of The talent, the tenacity, in tenacity, you have to have fortitude when things get a little tough. You know, I remember when Don't You was in the 30s, and one week it'd move up a number, the next week it'd move back a number, and we're sitting there for maybe what was 10 weeks of this 54-week experience, and that's where some people give up.
Yeah,
you know, and I had to make the call, and this is part of what I do as the head of the label. No, we're going to get this. You know, now I don't do that just whimsically. I try to do it with every bit of input around me. And what I found in that case of Brett is radio loved him, right? And it's always it's a crowded.
Now you're talking about the persona or the music?
Both.
Okay.
But they really loved him when he went out and did his promo tours. You know, he developed real friends out there at radio, so that when it came down, and I don't remember what song we were competing with to finally get the number one, but it took some extra, I love him, I'm going to give him extra spins to make this happen, which really, you know, that's part of the responsibility of a label promo team, but it's a lot easier when they also happen to say, I want this kid to get there.
Yeah, you know? Well, I mean, listen, it's everything and whatever you do, it's about relationships. And I don't care if you sell widgets or you're running a label. You've got to be likable, but you've also got to be talented. Listen, Patrick is super likable. But
but you heard the podcast,
but you heard the podcast theme song, yeah. And you know it's from not, hearing that.
Yeah,
it's probably not in the cards.
Yeah, that's fine.
I'm sorry. You were just an example. You're the closest person to me. So growing up, I'm trying to pinpoint your accent. Where are you from originally?
You want to take a guess?
I won't because I know the answer.
Somewhere in the Northeast.
Can I give him a hint?
Sure.
Groundhog Day.
Pennsylvania. Oh, I almost said Pennsylvania.
No, more specific.
Punxsutawney?
I'm the only person you've ever met from Punxsutawney, yes,
you
Pennsylvania.
You're Ned Ryerson.
Ned Ryerson. Bing.
Wow.
I am, man. I was born there.
Was that a mess with all? Is it like nutty?
On February 2nd, this town of 5,000 people becomes 35,000 people. And you just don't. It's goofy. Right? And this thing has a batting average, I think, of about 45%. So it makes it even goofier.
Right. So, I see the guys in, like, the tuxes.
And the top hats.
The top hats.
That's pretty cool.
Now,
that's a big deal for you to become the.
And they take it very seriously.
Oh, they do. The five
or six
of them.
Is that an election? How does somebody become the Punxsutawney Phil guy?
There's a building, and you wait to see if the smoke turns white.
Yeah. Yeah. The Punxsutawney Pope.
See, that's a Punxsutawney Pope reference. I like it.
I tell you a funny Punxsutawney story. So groundhogs are burrowing animals, right? Uh-huh. We all know this. And Phil and Phyllis are the same ones since like 1860, right?
Right. It's the longest living animals ever.
Well, yeah. But, you know, even though the average lifespan for these rodents is about 12 years, they're in their hundreds.
Yeah.
Well, Punxsutawney built a new civic center and decided they were going to put a groundhog's home in the middle so people could come in the foyer and see Phil and Phyllis. But they forgot that they would burrow out, and they burrowed out completely from
the building?
From a building. And the headlines were reading, Phil and Phyllis is missing. Right?
There's been a jailbreak.
So they have to take all the dirt out of this thing, put cement walls in it, fill it back in, and then claim they found Phil and Phyllis.
I can just see like the Punxsutawney like police chief at a press conference.
Yeah, he walks up to the podium. He's like, look, so we got an APB. If anyone sees, it holds up
an
picture
all
of
Phil
this.
Bulletin.
Yeah, anyone sees this groundhog?
Oh yeah, they probably had signs all over the.
We've been in touch with the
telephone
state police.
Poles.
Have
and
you
the
seen
FBI.
This groundhog?
So you grew up there, and then you seem like you're I don't know how tall you are. Pretty tall. You probably play basketball some.
I was about 50 pounds lighter than I am now. At 6'3", I was like 150.
Oh, wow.
And so I tried to play ball, but my, and this is the greatest excuse that ever happened in my life. A doctor said I was growing too fast and my joints were too weak to take hits because I tried to play football. He said, you can't play sports. I said, Fantastic. I joined the marching band the next day.
So is that how
I could hang out with the cheerleaders?
Yeah.
Is that how you got into to music through the band and playing music?
Well, you know, I am the classic since the day I had diapers. My parents actually have a photo that I have saved of me at 3 years old. I would come down and turn on the record player. I was fanatic about music. Fanatical, and it would come down in the middle of the night and turn it on, so they unplugged it. So I got a stool and stood there and had my hand in the middle, and they tell me I would just sing while I was spinning the record. I went to the Catholic school in Punxsutawney and sang in the choir from first grade on. By the time I was in junior high, I was the best drummer in the school. So I was in the orchestra, the marching band, the stage band, the pit orchestra for the musicals, like three different courses. It was my life. It just was an insane passion. When I went to college, I was a music major for the first year because I got a scholarship, but I hated the discipline of it because I'm also a kind of a rebel. And I said, I don't want to do all that. I just want to be Max Weinberg. I just got to find a Bruce Springsteen and I'm going to be Max Weinberg. Isn't that?
Yeah.
So I had bands through college and got a journalism degree, actually. But I was playing in two different bands, and while I'm doing it, I was the head of the radio station as for programming, our college station. I booked the concerts. I was the head writer for music in the school paper. It just was, you know, it
You're
is.
All in. You're
yeah,
all
how
in.
How do you make that leap from doing that to getting involved with the record labels and then eventually running record labels?
It was a very circuitous path. I will just tell you that when I couldn't find a job in journalism, I saw a help wanted sign for a record store, and it started there. So with my college degree in hand, I took a job for minimum wage in a record store in Washington, D.C. And lucky for me, 2 days later, the regional manager came in and said, "What are you doing here?" And I said, "Listen, I just need to keep putting food on the table while I try to get a job." I'd gone to D.C. with that altruistic purpose that many men have, which is I chased the girl with the hottest ass from college. That's the only reason I was in Washington, D.C., right? And then they found out I was a really good record store manager and kept promoting me to bigger store and bigger store. And a headhunter called me up and asked me if I wanted to be a buyer at Macy's. And I said, "Sounds good. I'd double my income," moved up to New York. And now I'm doing that. Think, well, this is how life progresses. And then Mitsubishi hires me to run their East Coast sales operation.
So you're still not in music.
No.
Wow.
And then here I was one day, and I looked at my now ex-wife, who had to put up with a lot of crap for me, and I said, "Honey, I'm going to get a job in the music business if it kills me, because I can't stand what I'm doing." And they were paying me very handsomely, but I said, "I don't care." So I took a pay cut, started running a big record retailer in New York, knowing I'd bump into people who were in jobs like mine. And thank God, 2 years later, I had three companies fighting to get me, and I went to PolyGram in 94. And from there, once I was inside the door, it was like, they're going to have to kill me to get me outside of this.
Yeah, that's the same kind of thing with radio. People ask us all the time, how do you get in radio? We're like, take whatever junk job you can get. It won't pay. It's going to be aggravating, but you're going to get your foot in the door. Once that happens, you can work your way up.
That's it, man.
It may take a long time, but it'll happen.
It's in your hands, and it certainly was. I mean, you know.
Do you see that kind of work ethic in the successful acts that you are now watching? Those ones who are the hard workers?
100%. You know. And having worked, you know, my story inside of the record companies was I ran sales for PolyGram, and then we were purchased by Universal, and they put three record labels together, Island, Def Jam, and Mercury, and I became the GM of Island Def Jam, we called it, right? So now I'm really in the world of Jay-Z and Saliva and Hoobastank and, you know, and Bon Jovi, which is a great story about how It's My Life came to be. But, you know, I'm in that space. I started coming down to Nashville about this time in the early 90s because I was fascinated with some artists like Mary Chapin Carpenter in particular, and I wanted to know what was going on. And I just noticed the artists down here are nicer.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah.
So then it was, how do I get there?
Yeah.
Right? And so now I come down here, and, you know, you go to, and I won't name any names, but it's kind of a standard story. The rock artists do one radio tour if they make it the whole way through it, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then you ask them when they've had success. Are you kidding?
And by the way, a radio tour, for those watching, is where they take an artist, a new singer sometimes, somebody who's been around for a while, and they just take them to radio stations around the country so they get to meet the DJs and everybody gets comfortable with each other, and that's what a radio tour is.
Yeah.
But the rock guys didn't like doing them?
They don't do them.
Not after the first one.
Yeah.
You know?
That's it.
And then I would tell them, look, Kenny Chesney still goes to radio stations. You know, and any time an artist comes into our office to audition for us, I'm very focused on whatever evidence of work ethic we can find. And we tell them the stories, you know, that you're going to be doing this on album 8 and 9 and 10, you know, get used to it. And
is that something that's in the contract? I mean,
no,
that they're required, or is it just a given?
It's a handshake, but, you know.
You've got to. You got to get out there, and you got to make these relationships with radio.
Well, it's like you said with Brett. I mean, people loved Brett, and then finally, whenever they got the songs that they felt fit their stations best, then they jumped all over it because they liked the song. But on top of it, they loved him.
That's exactly it. And I'm very proud of my roster of hardworking people. You know, the thing about our roster, which makes it riskier but more rewarding, is we have the smallest roster in town by far versus our competitors, and the highest batting average per artist. You know, last year we had 11 number one records out of 14 records released.
Wow.
The next closest got 12, but they released 36 singles in that time period. And it's, you know,
they're doing more of a shotgun, and you guys have a sniper kind of ethic.
That's my view of it, you know, and that's not to slam the competitors, because I actually quite like most of the competitors in town.
Who do you not like? and why?
But our boutique style means we better connect, because if you spend 40 weeks and it doesn't connect and you don't get any financial reward from it.
You've just wasted a lot of time and a lot of money.
Exactly. You know, but it's easier for us to face the artists and have them know we can't sleep at night if we don't break you, you know, and keep you going when we've got the momentum. The momentum's right there right now for Brett Eldridge and Cole Swindell, for us to get them to become the Lukes and Blakes, you know, and that becomes our job. We're the next layer under that. You've got Dan and Shay starting to have success, you know, and it's fun to watch the different places that artists are at, you know, so that I actually look at it like the evolution chart, you know, and Blake's fully erect, and we want all of our artists to be fully erect, damn it. So, you know, we've got to get them from Cro-Magnon to...
Yes. Do you have an issue with, like, let's say somebody comes in and you find this artist that you go, gosh, they're really good, but they're too similar to Cole Swindell, or I've already got a Hunter Hayes. I mean, do you find that you have to sometimes turn somebody down because it would be counterproductive towards somebody you already have?
Yeah, if they really blow us away, then we would have to really consider it. But the number, you know, here's a thing.
It's like the NFL draft, best player available or somebody that fits your team best.
You think about how the NFL draft has, I think I read once, 130,000 college football players. And the draft is 32 times, seven?
Yes.
So like about
230-ish players each year.
Right. So you talk about a filter system, right? My A&R team has to filter through about 7,000-8,000 submissions.
A year?
A year.
Wow.
They'll probably take meetings with about 300 to 400 of them without me knowing. You know, if they're really particularly enthused, right out of the gate, they'll bring me on board. But they know they don't want to use any bullets with me and have, you know, me get in. Not enthusiastic.
Do you get on them if they waste your time? Are you like, what are you doing?
You know, as much as I get on anybody. My whole toll is disappointment. You don't want to disappoint me.
Wow.
There's a picture of you with a tear. They're like, hey, we have this meeting, and you hold it out, and you just go, look, do you want this?
Have you ever been in these meetings where, like, they get in there? I just had this image in my head where they said, I'm just going to play my music. And they start up, and you're just like, okay, just stop. Stop. Time out.
Have I had that in my head a number of times?
Do you let them go all the way through the song, even if it's terrible? Good for you.
Well, we do. In fact, I tell them to play a second one.
Oh, wow.
You know, So about 60 artists end up making it through that filter system after the 300 or 400 with my A&R team, and we signed probably on average 2 a year. You know,
so out of the thousands to the 300 to the 60, you sign
two or three.
Oh wow!
You know, can't get the roster too big, or we can't pay attention at a level. You know,
and that's true.
We know have the like. The attitude that good is the enemy of great. You know,
that's a great quote.
We need people who just walk in the room, and you know it. You know they're a star.
Yeah, like Patrick.
That's it.
Exactly.
Have you heard his...
I want to hear it again.
There's a different version at the end. Just
there's this slow and poignant, sad version almost.
You're going to love it. Okay, I want to switch gears just a little bit. Do you have any stories from anything you said earlier, I'd like to, you know, you want to be funny, but do you have a story that, when I kind of told you to come in and do this, you could talk about whatever you want. Is there something specific you had in mind or...
Oh no, I make stuff up. You guys have no idea how many curse words I have edited myself.
We appreciate it
because you heard me about to say I got enough. But
yes,
right.
I'm making notes. Right. By the way, I'm going to hold this up. I have a little notepad
for later.
That's only two that you have to edit
that's
out.
That's right. I think yes.
Presuming ass is allowed in because you know
you sing it, so why not?
Yeah,
right.
So why not?
Do you remember that moment when that was? I'm trying to remember the first time that was even used in a
country.
Song.
Toes
in country.
It was put a boot in their ass. Toby Keith.
Oh yeah,
because he was talking about terrorists and everyone was fine with it.
Wow.
And then, like, a couple years later, when Toes came out, they made us edit it.
Yeah, because it wasn't okay.
Why can Toby say it, but they can't?
Because Toby was saying it about beating up terrorists.
But,
and let me tell you, there's
a difference. Blake has gotten away with it, though.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And why does he get to get away with it?
It's because we like him.
Everybody loves.
Chewbacca.
Yeah. Won't take no lip, yeah. That's not what he says in concert.
Really? It's shocking.
He says that S word that I just said that you just had to edit out.
So Espo, Blake came in to our studio years ago, 15 years ago
probably.
Maybe?
Yes.
Comes in, and we had done this bit on the air where we started with something like...
A trade-up kind of thing.
Yeah. Something that was like, hey, we have this. If you had something, trade us, and then we'll have this, and then we're going to trade for that. Just to see what kind of cool thing we could end up with at the end of the morning. So we ended up with the coolest thing that we could possibly get, which was a piece of taxidermy, and it was a baby coon with a bullfrog.
Actually, it was a possum.
No, the original one was a raccoon.
Was it
raccoon.
Really? Yeah, we had to change it to a possum. And he was there was a bullfrog on top of him riding him like
He was riding the bullfrog. It was a baby raccoon riding a bullfrog.
Like a bull. Like a bull rider.
That's right. He had his one hand in the air, and he's holding. So it's taxidermy of a baby raccoon riding a bullfrog.
It's dead animals. It's the dumbest thing ever. It's great.
Blake comes in and sees it. No one knows Blake. I mean, no name. He's like, that is awesome. What? How did you get that? And we told him the story, and he wanted us to give it to him. We're like, we're not giving you our frog. You're just not getting it. So every time he would come back in, he would bring up something about the taxidermy. So finally, when he got married, you have a picture of it?
Yep.
Show us about the picture.
We couldn't get a raccoon, so we got a possum.
We had to have one made for him.
We had one made. It's a possum riding a bullfrog. That's a picture of us handing it to him.
Now, doesn't that scream Blake Shelton?
Oh, it does.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
A month after we give it to him, we're wondering, I wonder if it's in his house. There's a picture of Blake in his rec room in Country Weekly.
And it was there.
And it's behind him.
You can see it.
It's up on top of the thing. And so we go, is it really in your house? He goes, yeah, I keep it on top of the ice maker because she can't reach it because she hates it. And she's threatening to tear it up.
God. We'd see Miranda and she'd be like, oh my God.
Why did you give him that ugly damn
it's
thing?
So awful.
You're the ones.
Yes, please don't let him have the. But yeah, it's a great example of just how real Blake is that, man, he really honestly loved it. And it meant a lot to him that we had it made for him and gave him for his wedding.
And he also never forgets. He's like an elephant.
He doesn't forget.
I was just going to say that. You know, he's one of the smartest people
Yep.
Not just artists, but people I've ever talked to in my life. And he'll remember a sentence you said 2 years later. And it, you know, and I have no governor on my mouth, so I just am going to trust that I'm not going to say something so off the reservation that I'm going to get in any trouble about it. But that's we could do a whole show on him, and boy, I wish, you know, we do the single picking process for Blake has become.
Like to pick the radio songs.
Yes, the next one, right? So we see this current single going so fast that we're having to pick the next one earlier than we normally would, right? Heck, this thing is number 14 after 3 weeks, right?
And, wow.
And,
yeah.
And this may be the shortest to the top for him.
Knock
that
on
was
wood,
wood yes. being wood. Knocked
that
on
is
right
real
there,
wood.
Right? It is real wood. It's pretty nice.
Thank
right?
you.
So we, I told after this occurred, while we're sitting out on the bus at the ACMs, I said to Narvel and Blake, we've got to start filming these things. They are the funniest half hour, 45 minutes that you could get. Because now we've picked seven songs that are potentials, and everybody has an opinion, right? Now, the real winner is always going to be Blake, and the second highest in the hierarchy is Scott Hendricks of A&R, because they're more qualified to pick than the rest of us, right? But we all get to weigh in. And when somebody has their heels dug in on one, they take shots at the other about why they would pick it, you know. And it's just, oh, my God, we're laughing. Scott Hendricks said, it's this one, right? He starts playing the song, and Narvel's making a face like he's about to puke. And then he makes the comment, which is classic. He goes, who's singing that song? Is that Luke or... you know, and he runs through
every artist.
His point being, you know,
it could
let's be
anybody.
A little more adventurous than that song. Somebody else picks another song, and then Blake says, "What do you like?" And I said, "The Scott song." And I wasn't trying to be nice to Scott. I actually thought the song was very powerful. And Narvel says, "A dark cloud is just overcome the bus." And then, you know, it's all in fun, but it's so freaking funny. It would be a sitcom, single selection. And, you know, when you get to 16 in a row, it actually becomes a pretty, you know, you try to be thoughtful about it with any artist at any point, but we don't want to break that string.
You don't want the single you voted for to be the one that breaks the string.
Exactly.
Because then the next time they do single selection, everybody's like, going to be like, yeah, no, you picked the last one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I might not even be allowed on the bus the next time.
Is there an artist that you, that got away from you and that you regret getting out of your...
Somebody you could have signed, but you...
You let them go. Or they didn't, for whatever reason.
There are artists that we really wanted to sign that ended up signing at a competitor, you know. And, you know, they know who they are, so...
Okay.
Your listeners may not, ultimately. Hey, Casey Musgraves was one of them, right? And we were incredibly close on Maren Morris, who I think is an incredibly talented person. You know, we can't get them all. But I do know, you know, the converse of that is... we signed a band called High Valley that everybody was in and trying like crazy to get, right? And Cole Swindell, every label, competitive, massive bids coming from everybody. So we win some, we lose some. I'm happy we generally don't lose the ones I'm insanely passionate about, you know. But it's a hell of a process.
What is that process like? Is it
who's the winner, the artist or the label?
You know, ultimately... We say to the artist, once you're signed, now the work begins, and you don't know because it's a crapshoot, like we were talking about way earlier in the conversation. Now, did we pick the right artist? And by God, you know, by the time that we take an artist to the world and have tried to work single number one, the average that a record label is spending is about $750,000 to $1 million. And you already put yourself in a position where if you can't sell a couple hundred thousand albums, you're underwater, right?
Right.
But it's the way. By the time you've recorded the record, you've done the styling, you've created the video, you've put them on the road to go visit 100 radio stations, and you add all that stuff up, you know, you've spent real money. And so who's the winner? You know, we all are if we get the Brett Eldridge version.
Right.
We all aren't. I have an artist named Charlie Worsham who is one
just
of the
about
most
to ask,
talented artists.
Is there
artists.
Anybody, who is the guy that you think should be a bigger star than they are, and I already knew the answer was going to be
Charlie. And Charlie's been recording now for a year with Frank Liddell, a producer who's done all of Miranda's records, but many other wonderful, massive records.
That Aubrey Sellers record that we featured, and
Yeah, you guys had her in here, and she sang a Beach Boys song, saw.
It was amazing.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
And so Charlie's one of those artists where, and literally, I mean, I'm talking a little out of school, but he switched management, and one of the people who was vying for him came to meet me and said, I just want to know how committed you are to Charlie. And I said, let me put it this way. Despite how underwater we are, Charlie Worsham will be on this record label as long as I'm running this record label. Wow. And I intend to run it for a long time.
I'm so glad to hear that.
You know, we got the right artist. We just have to find the right music, the right producer, and get it back out there.
He's such a nice guy, too.
He's so great. Like, he did a set of residency shows where he was just trying out new material. He played like 4 weeks in a row at this little bitty club. I went to three of those. Because I just think he's one of the best singer songwriters, guitar players, just the most talented people. He was on the road with Vince Gill.
Oh, Patrick's got another man crush.
No, I do, and it's one of those guys where you go, who doesn't get this?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, this sea to sea thing, country to country thing that's taking place in London now in the fourth year, and I've been to the last two. It was about 2 or 3 weeks ago. Has gone from selling 17,000 tickets 4 years ago to 65,000 tickets, you know, selling four nights of the O2 Arena, which is Madison Square Garden-sized arena there. So country is getting traction in the U.K.
We have a ton of listeners that reach out to us every day.
Whether
they're listening through AFN or the internet, we have a ton of really, really passionate country fans from the UK and Europe in general.
Yeah. That's so wonderful to hear. So the night before the big stadium show starts, they have, actually it was three nights of sold out, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Thursday night, they have a songwriters round, you know, a guitar pool, as we call it here in Nashville, where five songwriters who happened to also be able to sing, get up there on the stage and, you know, tell the story about why they wrote a song that everybody's heard. But generally, it's not the artist, it's the songwriters. We had Charlie Worsham on this. It was Shane McAnally, who's written countless number one songs in the format. Ashley Monroe, one of our artists, singing like a bird, like she does. Charlie Worsham, Laurie McKenna. And who was, and Chip Esten, and playing his own songs, right?
From Nashville, the TV show.
Every time Charlie played, every one of them was staring over his fingers because he does ungodly things on the guitar.
Yeah.
And how he can sing and play that at the same time is crazy. Well, that was the only place Charlie played that weekend. His album went to number 4 on iTunes in the UK.
Wow.
Now,
do you think that was based off of just people talking and
the buzz, yes.
Wow.
And I'm thinking to myself, man, we get the right music for Charlie Worsham. We've got an international star because his music transcends country, you know, and I love country as much as anybody. Hell, I'm the chairman of the CMA this year. I'm blessed. But in the UK, if we don't refer to it as country, who cares, right? It's great music, and doors are opening there. And, you know, it'd be really nice because we've only had a couple of international stars in this format.
I think that's interesting. So in the UK, whenever you guys market an artist, it's just music. It's not country music. Even though it might be a Blake Shelton or a Charlie or whomever, you just say it's music.
Yeah, that's our style. And I'm finding our competitors are doing that more and more.
Wow.
You know, Casey
Because
Musgraves,
country means something different here than it does there.
Yeah, you know, being fresh from New York, even though it's 6 years, I still hear country and western in the United States.
Yeah.
You go outside of the United States, you hear a lot of, you're in that country western music, country and western music.
Well, it's just like on the awards the other night, you had, what's his name, the NFL guy
dressing
up like little Jimmy Dickens. Nobody does that anymore. I think it's bad that we have these.
Don't piss him off.
He's really big.
I'm just saying,
nobody dresses like that anymore. That continues to be perpetuated because...
Yeah,
because people don't know.
Listen, there's a fine line. What, you know, is and this is me personally speaking, the image of the Western, you know, is not for me.
Like the Roy Rogers old school.
But the other side of that isn't me either. There's that thing in the middle is me.
Yeah.
It's Blake. That's me. And I think a lot of people are there. And when it gets one way or the other way too far, I think that's when you start hearing chirping from people like, this isn't country.
This isn't country.
Or, what is this? And so, anyway.
I'm going to make a plug before I leave, and I'm going to have to leave here because I have an artist sitting in my office in 10 minutes who will be one of the 65.
Oh.
And the next time you guys invite me back, if you do, I'll let you know if I signed the guy.
Oh, yeah. It's kind of exciting.
First letter. Give us the first letter.
D.
Okay, gotcha.
Like Big D.
Hey, exactly.
Who knew? I guess I got to be gone here in a few minutes.
But here's my plug. I signed a band with Scott Hendricks last November that is so amazing. I cannot wait for you to hear The Last Bandoleros. I described the music as the Beatles meets Tex-Mex meets Buck Owens. It has such flavors. Two of the kids are from San Antonio. One is the bass player, the son of Emilio, the famous Tejano star.
Yeah,
yeah.
Right? One of the three is from Brooklyn. And they're three killer lead vocalists. They're all three instrumentalists on a profound level. And I'd give you one example, but I want everybody who's listening to this thing to go Google The Last Bandoleros. And check out their website and check out their video for Where Do You Go? Because it's crazy, crazy fun. And then we bring it to the world in June, and somewhere down the road, you'll remember that I was this enthusiastic. They came over to my office after a little gathering of radio people that we had. It wasn't just radio, it was press. We did this little event and had them come over. And 11 o'clock, the guitars come out. There wasn't a song anybody could mention that they couldn't play because they know the swath, right? Country or pop. So at 1 a.m, somebody says, jokingly, Abbey Road front to back. They played Abbey Road flawlessly front to back, sequenced perfectly.
The entire album.
At wow. 40 minutes later, these kids just nailed it. Are you looking at the last
Bandoleros?
Yeah, I'm
looking at it right now.
Yeah, I'm trying to use the last band.
Bandoleros.
Last Bandoleros.
Yeah.
The last Bandoleros.
I'll turn my screen that way. D-A-N-D-O-L.
Can we play? Can we play some of that off the thing? Or
yeah.
Get in trouble?
If you got, Where Do You Go? Play it.
I mean, well, I'm just on their website. I sent you the link.
Can we play? Can we play
oh wait,
that's
turn,
it.
You got to turn us down real quick. Okay, there we go.
Oh, Bubba already likes it.
Yeah.
See, it's got an accordion.
It's got harmonica. Anything? I love all that stuff, man.
Check these harmonies out.
And this is out now?
It's out so you can get it on YouTube.
June will be the day.
June is okay, when well, here's, going to here's attack radio.
My invitation. You bring them. We'll put them on the air.
Oh,
I promise.
That would be great.
It's done.
Sounds fun, man. Cool. I love these. Sounds great.
I saw him play a concert. Espo had a party after one of the big radio seminars, and these guys played, and it was just...
Oh, it was them?
Now, granted...
You were drunk?
Yeah, there was free margaritas. Now, listen, and they were good margaritas.
Yes,
that was
we did offer free beer and free margaritas.
And that was, that's like the best margarita or five margaritas I ever had.
Margarita-i.
And then afterwards, Espo has a party in this big hotel suite in downtown Nashville. And we go in there, and he's got a neon sign that says Espo's or Espo's Place.
Yeah, Espo's.
Espo's.
That was and not my idea, but I didn't fight it.
No, I wanted a neon sign of with my name until I saw his and went, dude, I want a neon sign with sign my name. Envy.
John, thanks for joining us, man. We appreciate it. And hopefully your meeting goes well and you find the next Blake Shelton.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be something?
Thank you. It has been a blast, and you guys have been incredibly supportive of my humble little roster. So thank you for that.
Well, you got some. You have great talent, you really do. And it's just interesting to hear all the behind the scenes stuff of the industry. Are we about to hear Patrick sing the Alps?
Yep. Yeah,
here we go.
Okay, wait. I do have to say a big shout-out to our sponsor again, LifeLock. No one can prevent all identity theft or monitor all transactions.
LifeLock.
At all businesses, but seriously, LifeLock Ultimate Plus provides the most comprehensive identity theft protection. You want to go to LifeLock.com right now and use promo code BIGD, one word, B-I-G-D, for 10% off and take advantage of that.
Are you going to give the thumbs up or thumbs down?
No, I want to. Next time I come, if you ever do allow me to come back, I want to read a promo.
Okay.
Oh,
my voice isn't so bad.
No, you have a great voice. Right? Yeah. So you have a better radio voice than me.
Can you read the first one on this page?
Here, how about this? Since you have a better radio voice than me, why don't you let me go let you know if this artist is any good?
Hi, this is John Esposito, and you're listening to Big D and Bubba.
See, you did that well.
Wow.
That's really good.
Radio-y and everything.
Hi, this is John Esposito, and you're listening to The Weekend Wake Up with Big D and Bubba. Okay.
Get out of here.
Now he's just showing off.
Hit it, Patrick. Here we go.
This was the podcast, but now it's over, but that's okay, because you can listen to the regular show on the radio. Every day.
Harmonies, baby.
That's right. It was the podcast.
Now you're just showing off.
Showing off!